You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources is investigating PFAS contamination. That's a class of toxic chemicals that don't break down in the environment at about 100 sites around the state. But the DNR's authority to do anything about the contamination took a hit this week when a Waukesha County judge's ruling denied the department's authority to force businesses to clean up the chemicals. The problem, the judge says, is there isn't a state statute about them, at least not yet. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are PFAS, sometimes called forever chemicals, a problem in your community where you live? If your water has PFAS contamination, is anything going on to try to fix it? How has it affected your town, your city, your family? Do you have thoughts or questions about the ruling this week from that Waukesha County judge? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll start out with a look at the experience of one Wisconsin city dealing with the problem. Katie Rosenberg is the mayor of the city of Wausau. Mayor Rosenberg, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me today.
How big a problem do you have in Wausau with PFAS?
So I think our problem is a little bit exacerbated by the lack of legislation we have both federally and statewide. Our problem is we're about between 20 parts per trillion and maybe 40 parts per trillion in some wells. And of course we wanna be lower than that because we heard from the DHS and the DNR that we shouldn't have that in our water system. So it's complicated, we found out. And then of course the DNR had their special session to talk about it. We've been talking to the EPA, but the DHS still has their health advisory. So I would say it's a problem. We're trying not to panic and we don't want people to panic. Mm-hmm. And we're working methodically to get it removed from our system once we have our new drinking water facility online. But in the meantime, we're bringing in several different kinds of short-term fixes.
Yeah, what are some of those short-term fixes? We've heard around the state everything from this community is bringing in bottled water to, well, we're just shutting down this one well and that is going to take care of it for now. What kind of things are you doing?
Yeah, so we looked at the well solution because we have one well that seems a little bit hotter than the others, but that won't work with us because there's a complicating factor with that well being a Superfund site. So we brought in short-term bottled water, and then we also ordered tons of pitchers from a company that filters out the PFAS in the water. So we're doing that. We're also working on bench testing and pilot testing some resins and different kinds of activated carbon to see how it's doing. And we have some promising results for maybe a near-term solution at our current facility. And we're also hoping to inform the solution to our brand new facility that will open later this summer.
There are a lot of different sources, different uses for these chemicals around the state. What do you know about the origins of the PFAS in the Wausau area?
Right. So we don't have exactly a handle on where that is. You know, we'll work with the DNR to identify that responsible party. But like a lot of cities in Wisconsin, we have heritage that's industrial along that Wisconsin River. So we're anticipating some of that to come from industry. And then, you know, it's everywhere. It is everywhere from what gets spread on farm fields to your frying pans, everything. So we're trying to get as much out of it as we can, but it's a challenge when you just have this ubiquitous chemical.
What would you like to see either at the state or the federal level when it comes to guidelines and maybe help with cleanup?
Oh, my goodness. First of all, very clear guidelines will be critical for us and for any municipality dealing with this. So right now what we have is we have advisories from both the DNR and the Environmental Protection Agency, which are great. But it's not regulatory standards. So we're struggling with now we have to decide where we want to be as a city when it comes to this standard. So we know that the Department of Health Services says that it's a hazard. We shouldn't have it in our water. And that's what we're going with right now. We would like to get below 20 parts per trillion, as close to zero as we can. You know, we've talked about it at our meetings. The council seems decisive in that we want to be as far below 20 parts per trillion as we can, just because we want to get rid of that health hazard in the water. But, you know, we obviously want to have a more cohesive answer for our neighbors and our entire state and nation. We care about people.
There are lots of mayors in the state and city managers and county executives, and the list goes on, dealing with some version of this problem. Are you in contact with your peers around the state to try to share solutions?
Oh, yes, we are. So one of the cool things about Wausau being right here in Marathon County is that we have pretty good relationships with our surrounding municipalities. So once we actually tested after the DNR asked us to, because Rib Mountain, our neighboring municipality, tested, and they had a pretty hot well. So we tested, and then other municipalities also tested, and we're all kind of getting similar results. Some are a little more PFAS in the water than others. But we've been talking about what does a regional approach look like? And we've asked some questions of the EPA, and they're interested in helping us figure out what that regional approach looks like. And obviously, we have things like the bipartisan infrastructure bill and our ARPA funding that can help fund these solutions. And so we can only be more effective together. So we're talking about this at our Metropolitan Planning Organization because, water is infrastructure too.
Mayor Rosenberg, thanks for joining us today.
Of course, thank you for having me.
Katie Rosenberg is the mayor of Wausau. She joined us for a look at PFAS contamination and efforts to solve the problem in her community. Now we turn to wider issues of regulation of these chemicals and the law here in Wisconsin. David Strifling is a professor and director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative at Marquette University Law School. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Rob. Thanks for having me again.
Well, we've got this ruling from a judge that says, hey, DNR, you can't regulate this chemical. You can't mandate cleanup in part. What went into this ruling?
Well, I think this is another chapter in the ongoing debate at the national and state levels about the role of agencies. Do we trust them as experts, or are they unelected bureaucrats who have too much power? That's sort of the division here. How much discretion should DNR have? So we've talked previously about DNR's efforts to set standards for PFAS in surface water and groundwater and drinking water. This one's a little different. We're talking now about DNR's authority to require cleanup or remediation of PFAS that are already in the environment when that release was caused by some particular entity. And that's what the decision yesterday or this week, I should say, was all about.
We heard from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. They're a group that backed a local business person who was challenging DNR regulation and requirement of cleanup of PFAS. The gist they had was like, there's no official state mandate on this. There's no guide. There's a recommended guideline, but nothing else. If we apply that kind of standard to enforcement actions for the DNR, it really is a big question mark for businesses. What do you think of that argument?
Right. So the spills law essentially says that anyone who owns or controls, quote unquote, hazardous substances have to notify DNR of any release of that substance and also take actions necessary to restore the environment. Now, the issue is that hazardous substances are pretty broadly defined as essentially anything that causes harm to human health or the environment. So DNR has a lot of discretion or had a lot of discretion in determining what fits that definition. Now, yesterday's ruling said there's no list of hazardous substances, at least not one that's publicly available, not one in the statute and not one in the regulation. So the court says that DNR has to create one, has to go through the rulemaking process. And as we've seen with the standard setting process, that can take years. So the concern is, from a societal perspective, I think, going beyond DNR's perspective or the business perspective, that we're not going to see these sites being cleaned up. We want a fair process for sure, but we want the sites to be cleaned up.
Do we have measures in place that would allow the DNR to stop someone who's currently releasing these chemicals into the environment?
Well, I think it's questionable. From DNR's perspective, this is a case, we have a saying in the law that bad facts make bad law. And I'm sure that's what DNR is thinking about this case, that, the plaintiff, Leather Rich, who was backed by WMC, had a cleanup plan in place. And DNR apparently changed the cleanup requirements midstream to require a PFAS remediation as well. And the remediation plan that was there at the beginning was no longer approved by the DNR. And the court had a big problem with that, said that this pulls the rug out from under the responsible party and it's a violation of due process. Part of the issue here too is the court just made an oral ruling from the bench, didn't prepare anything in writing. So we're going to have to really wait and see the transcript before we decide what it means for, say, ongoing cleanups. But I do think that is a concern if I were at the DNR that, you know, especially those ongoing cleanups that are focused on PFAS and potentially other substances as well are thrown into question by this ruling. And certainly your hypothetical question about somebody who's releasing PFAS now would fall into that same category. I think DNR's authority is thrown into question by this ruling.
We're talking to David Strifling, director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative at Marquette University Law School. We're looking at the DNR's ability to regulate PFAS, the so-called forever chemicals, after a ruling this week from a Waukesha County judge appears to limit that power. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much authority do you think the DNR should have to require cleanup of this particular pollutant and to prevent it from being released into the environment? Do you want to see that power being kept in check as it is under this court ruling? What questions do you have about Wisconsin's spills law, a key part of the story here? And is this a problem in your own community, in your local water? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with David Strifling, director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative at Marquette University Law School, looking at the DNR and its authority to regulate contamination cleanup, specifically around PFAS, after a court ruling says that isn't specified in current rules and current laws, so you can't necessarily require cleanup. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about this, your experiences if this is an issue in your own community. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Shane is with us in Appleton. Shane, hi.
Hello, good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up, Shane?
Well, I guess I don't quite understand how this is a question of, you know, somebody has to be responsible for this contamination, and there needs to be some oversight. I just don't understand how this is even a question.
Shane, thanks for the call. David, why, we've talked about this a little, why is this a question?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. Somebody has to be responsible, and in some cases, we know who the entity is who's responsible for the pollution. But the question is, the legal question anyway, is what's the process by which we have to tell that person what to do? What is the standard by which that responsible party has to clean up the environment? And that's what the plaintiffs were arguing in the court case, that this is, the way it's set up now, just sort of unlimited discretion on the part of DNR. And the court agreed in this case that that's a violation of the responsible party's due process. So, you know, I've read a lot of headlines that say DNR doesn't have the ability anymore to regulate PFAS. I don't think that's quite what the court was saying. DNR still has the authority to regulate PFAS, the court said. It's just got to go through the right process to do that. And, you know, we can certainly disagree about whether the length of time that it takes to go through that process is reasonable. But I think that's what the court was driving at in its ruling.
Shane, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. David, Shane was talking about a situation where we know who was responsible for this particular PFAS problem. How about, as we were talking to the mayor of Wausau earlier, what if we don't know? We know there were five industries that probably at some point released these chemicals in the environment. We can't point toward this well and say, ah, Company A's emissions were the problem here. Even supposing DNR gets these rules in place, how hard does that make enforcement and trying to get somebody to be accountable for cleanup?
That certainly compounds the issue when you have a causation question and you can't even prove that one entity caused the spill. That only makes DNR's job harder. You know, what we're talking about now really in these cases that have been in front of the courts, whether it's Johnson Controls or Leather Rich, we know the entity who's responsible. It's just the cleanup standard. That's the question. If we don't even know that first part of the equation, that certainly makes DNR's job a lot harder, and there's no easy answer to that. And we see it a lot in environmental cases, toxic torts. The causation question is really difficult.
We are talking about PFAS pollution in Wisconsin, the DNR's authority to regulated to require cleanup that took a hit, at least for now, in a court ruling. Still time for your calls with questions, your thoughts, your comments at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, the standards for PFAS. Now, the last I saw, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, this is at the federal level, says their guidelines, 70 parts per million. Wisconsin's Health Department, 70 parts per trillion. The Department of Health Services in Wisconsin saying 20 parts per trillion. They're very different numbers. They're both guidelines, not mandates. Does that make the regulation here more difficult?
Well, this is where DNR has to go through the standard setting process. And so that's a different question from this court decision in Waukesha County this week that has to do with the cleanup process once they're already in the environment. So yeah, DNR has to go through that standard setting process that could take, 30 months, 36 months. And that culminated in the February hearing before the Natural Resources Board where, some of the standards were approved, some aren't. And even then in Wisconsin, you've still got to get legislative approval for some of these rules. So it's a lengthy process. And this would be, I can say with some confidence, a lot easier if we had federal standards in place. And I think the Biden administration and the Biden EPA is working toward that goal, but it isn't there yet. And so what we're seeing is a lot of states moving forward, kind of piecemeal without the guidance of a federal standard in place. And that's certainly slowing things down here.
Which is likely to happen faster, a set of federal standards or going through this rulesmaking process in Wisconsin?
It's hard to say, and it depends on, that would vary on a state-by-state basis. The process in Wisconsin is a little bit longer than in some other states, but what we're seeing is the states are moving faster, at least at this point, that the states are putting their own regulations in place before we see anything on the federal level. The federal process isn't that short either. The federal EPA still has to go through a notice and comment rulemaking process that can take years on its own, so it's a little bit of a horse apiece, but we can only wish that EPA would have gotten an earlier start on all this.
So if the DNR wants a rule in place, and supposing that key lawmakers are willing to give their part of their approval to it, like what is the next step for that? What kind of things would have to happen now to start that clock, start that timeline?
So I think, if I were at DNR, a few things to do here. One is, again, what we have from the court is an oral ruling. We would need a transcript right away to prepare to really analyze what the court's decision is and what the basis for it is. Then, and DNR has already done this, it will file a motion to stay the ruling, and the parties are going to brief that, and that will be decided in June. That means that the ruling would be put on pause while it's appealed, which I also expect will happen here in some form, that DNR will appeal this ruling. But while all that is going on in the legal track, the legal side, I think DNR also will begin preparing a list of some sort of the hazardous substances that it will consider to be hazardous substances under the spills law, for the context of the spills law. Because another thing about all of this that I think is being missed is we're not just talking about PFAS here. We're talking more broadly about DNR's authority to define what are hazardous substances under the spills law. So, is DNR going to have to go through a lengthy rulemaking for every new emerging contaminant that comes down the pike or for substances that it previously has enforced under the spills law, like manure spreading and even milk dumping from dairies, things that we don't normally consider ultra hazardous substances or even hazardous substances in some cases? All that is called into play, I think, by the court's ruling here. So, DNR has to start thinking about if this doesn't go its way, what are we going to do to get some kind of a list in place and start a rulemaking process that ultimately is going to take us through a lengthy time period that starts with a scope statement approved by the Natural Resources Board, gets public comment and public hearing, finally gets approved by the Natural Resources Board, and then goes back to the legislature. So, I think DNR's got to be moving forward on a couple of tracks here. One is an appeal of the judge's ruling, but another is if that ruling stands, what do we do next? And that probably starts with the preparation of a list.
if I own, say, a company that's currently under a cleanup agreement for PFAS, or as you say, a lot of different stuff, does this ruling for now, unless it stayed, open the door for me to go back and say, hang on, under this precedent, I don't need to do this?
Well, I think it opens a window. And again, in this case, it was a little bit unusual in that DNR changed course in the middle of the cleanup. So I think, you know, depending on the substance and how the process has gone, it could open a door. It doesn't necessarily do that. But I would be surprised if the company's attorneys aren't undertaking the kind of review that you just sketched out as we speak.
In our last few moments, what are you watching for next on this story, David?
Well, I think we've got to see what happens next from a DNR's point of view. You know, are they going to appeal? I certainly would expect that. Is the court going to grant a stay of the ruling, which would, again, put things on pause while an appeal goes forward? And what does DNR say publicly about, you know, the other possibility that, you know, this ruling stands, and what DNR will do next if it remains in place?
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
David Strifling is director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative at Marquette University Law School. We talked with him about PFAS and the Wisconsin DNR's ability to regulate PFAS contamination cleanup. As we've heard, a new wrinkle on that question coming out of a court in Wisconsin this week. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, inflation numbers stayed on the high side in the latest reports. Can the Federal Reserve tackle that problem without risking a recession? An economist breaks down the quest to slow down inflation, and you can join in with your questions, your comments, maybe your experiences in dealing with inflation yourself. Let us know if you have a question right now. You can email centraltime@wpr.org. Plus, we'll meet a Milwaukee artist who uses water to create unique art that tells the story of Black history. Those stories and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we're talking about noodles and pasta and all their many varieties on this week's edition of Food Friday, and you can join in with your favorite noodle dishes. First, research has found that COVID-19 infection significantly increases the risk of developing diabetes. A study published in the medical journal Lancet last month found that the risk of getting type 2 diabetes increased 40% among those infected with COVID compared with those who didn't get COVID. COVID's also been shown to increase the risk of type 1 diabetes in those under age 18 compared to those who never got COVID. We're talking about this research finding the link between COVID infection and later diabetes diagnosis, especially type 2. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something that you've been through yourself? Did you or a loved one develop diabetes after a COVID infection? What questions do you have about the link between COVID and diabetes? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Dawn Belt-Davis is a professor in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine. She's an expert in type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Dr. Davis, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, Dr. Davis, I'd heard a lot about the risks of COVID for people who already had diabetes. That seems like it's been pretty clear for a while. This was news to me, though, that having been through COVID, you have an elevated risk of being diagnosed with diabetes. What do we know about that so far?
Right. Yeah. So you're right. There has been pretty clear evidence from the beginning of the pandemic that patients who have an obesity or type 2 diabetes seem to be at increased risk for more severe outcomes related to COVID infection. And what has been emerging now over the last, several months as we compile all the information from the patients who've been infected with COVID over the last 2 years, it's honestly, there's some conflicting data. A vast majority of the studies do seem to support that there's an increased risk of patients developing diabetes after they've had a COVID infection. So we know that while they have their COVID infection and they're in the hospital, they definitely are at higher risk of having high blood sugars or diabetes. But these are even patients who are now recovered from COVID, more than a month up to a year or so after their infection. And we're seeing increased rates of diabetes, new diabetes diagnosis during those time periods.
I know type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes, we call it both diabetes. They're both kind of different in their causes, their outcomes. There's some overlapping treatment. Are we seeing elevated risks of both of these kinds of diabetes post-COVID?
Yeah, so that's a great point. So type 2 diabetes is the form of diabetes that we typically think of more in adults. It's associated with obesity and is the most common form of diabetes. And that's where most of the data comes from, is looking at patients who had newly diagnosed diabetes. Most of those were with type 2 diabetes. And, you know, the reasoning behind why we're seeing this increased incidence with COVID infection, we really don't know that answer. There's a lot of theories. We know that the COVID virus itself can actually infect the cells within your body, the beta cells that make insulin. So it could be a direct damage to those insulin producing cells. We also know that with infection, there's increased amounts of these inflammatory signals and stress hormones that can worsen diabetes or lead to diabetes. But there's some other interesting, you know, ideas too. One is that a lot of patients may not have had good access to medical care or not having frequent medical care. And then after their COVID infection, they come in for more medical care and may be diagnosed with diabetes that could have possibly even been there before their diagnosis. And this is an important point because we know that if you look across the board, about, you know, 20% of the people who have diabetes are actually undiagnosed. They don't even realize they have it. So possibly some of these signals we're seeing could actually just be from patients having more medical care and getting diagnosed. And then the last important point is that we know that COVID infection has hit certain populations harder than others, particularly in this country. And some of those populations do have higher risk factors for diabetes due to social determinants of health, things like lower socioeconomic status, less access to high quality food, less access to the ability to exercise. And so, again, comparing apples to oranges, sometimes we might see an increased rate of diabetes in these patients that may be explained by something other than the infection. So it's complicated. And then briefly to touch on the type 1 diabetes story, type 1 diabetes is caused by autoimmune disease, and it happens usually in children or young adults. And in this case, we know that type 1 diabetes sometimes is triggered by a virus infection. And so there's a possible link there with the COVID virus and type 1 diabetes. But the data there is still emerging, whether there's truly an increased rate of type 1 or not in patients with COVID infection.
Talking to Dr. Dawn Belt Davis, professor in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at UW's School of Medicine, looking at links between COVID-19 and different kinds of diabetes. As we're hearing, a lot of research going on, more still needed. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. Dr. Davis, what are you hoping to see? Do you think we should be monitoring people after COVID, watching closely for potential signs of diabetes?
Yeah, I think that certainly in, you know, the adult population, particularly those who already have risk factors for diabetes, I think absolutely after COVID infection, they should have a little closer monitoring and, you know, be screened for diabetes on a more regular basis. In kids, it's a little harder with the type 1 diabetes because, again, we aren't 100% clear on that connection, and we don't routinely screen children for type 1 diabetes either. But certainly if they had other risk factors, it would be important to follow up on that.
And flipping things back around, and the elevated risk for people, as you were saying earlier, who have type 2 diabetes, why did that make them more vulnerable to severe impacts of COVID?
Yeah, and that's a great question, too. I think, you know, those patients tend to have some other things going on at the same time. They often also have high blood pressure, are at higher risk for heart disease and stroke, are more susceptible just to having those very high blood glucose levels during their infection, which can make it harder to treat and manage the infectious process. So sort of a whole bunch of factors that play into that.
In general, for people who have been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, whether it's post-COVID or not, what are the main things they need to do when it comes to treatment and healthy lifestyle?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the number one thing is making sure that we have patients being screened for diabetes and being, you know, diagnosed as soon as possible. When they are diagnosed, you know, managing their diabetes usually involves a combination of things, but medications are often required. It's not necessarily something that you can manage with diet and exercise alone. In some patients with type 2 diabetes, they may even require insulin therapy. And so it's just important to follow up with your healthcare providers and find the right treatment for you. Importantly, we want patients to recognize that diabetes is a disease like everything else, and it needs medical treatment. We don't want patients to feel like that they're necessarily always to blame for their diabetes, and which there's a lot of stigma sometimes around that. So it's important to recognize, get good medical care, do your best on lifestyle changes, but, you know, focus on getting the treatment that you need.
Dr. Davis, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
You too. That's Dr. Dawn Belt-Davis, professor in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at UW's School of Medicine. She talked to us about COVID and its link with diabetes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. In just a few minutes, we're going to turn to insulin and the cost of insulin, a bill in Congress aimed at reducing the cost. How big a deal is that for you and your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. The U.S. House passed a bill last month that would cap the price of insulin at $35 a month. People with type 1 diabetes need insulin to survive. It can also help people with type 2 control blood sugar and avoid complications like kidney damage and nerve damage. Human Rights Watch earlier this month called unaffordable insulin in the U.S. a human rights abuse. Supporters of the bill say they want to make affordable insulin a reality for the nearly 2 million Americans with type 1 who need it to live. Others who benefit from the therapy would still need to pass in the U.S. Senate to take effect. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you or someone in your family relies on insulin, can you talk about the cost? How affordable, how available is it for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Vincent Rajkumar is a professor at the Mayo Clinic and editor of Nature's Blood Cancer Journal. He's the author of a research paper titled The High Cost of Insulin in the United States, an Urgent Call to Action. Dr. Rajkumar, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, starting with this bill, it passed the House, still waiting for action in the Senate. How big a deal would it be for the cost of insulin?
Well, I think it's a small step forward, not a big move, because it covers one drug. It covers copay, which is important to patients, and it caps the copay at $35, as you said, but it doesn't cap the cost of insulin. So if the cost keeps going up and the copay is kept constant, then the premiums and taxes would go up on everyone else. And then finally, it doesn't cover the uninsured and the underinsured, who are the ones paying facing a lot of this burden. About 25% of the insured population will benefit because they are currently paying more than $35 or more for their insulin.
I talked to you about this when your paper that I referenced came out, Dr. Rajkumar. Can you compare and contrast the cost, the price of insulin in the United States with other comparable industrialized countries?
It's a huge difference, and that's what makes it such a big problem. It's the same insulin. It's the same insulin since, you know, the late 90s and 2000s till now. And it costs at least 10 times more in the U.S. for all types of analog insulins than in any of the other developed countries. So the reports are like, you know, you can compare to 30 different countries with benchmarked, and we would be insulin costs in the U.S. are 10 times or more higher.
What drives that?
Well, we have a number of issues here. There is no negotiation on the price of insulin, so it's whatever pharmaceutical companies set. There's a monopoly on the product itself, with very few companies controlling most of the market. And then there's a lot of people who benefit in the middle, from wholesalers to pharmacy benefit managers to others who all benefit from a high price. So it's multiple factors, as I outline in the paper, and it's not an easy solution.
What kind of solutions do you point to try to bring those numbers down?
I think negotiating for the price of insulin and capping the actual list price and lowering the list price would be the main thing, since Medicare Part D covers insulin, and allowing more biosimilars to enter the market so that there's competition would be another second step. Having some transparency in the arrangements between pharmaceutical companies and pharmacy benefit managers in terms of, you know, what is causing the difference between the list price and what, you know, insurance companies are paying for the product.
You mentioned all those other countries where insulin is way cheaper. Are those factors present there, or is it just a completely different system and it's kind of hard to compare the U.S. with what they're doing?
It's completely different system, because in almost all the developed countries, the government is paying for the cost of these drugs. And so they negotiate not just for insulin. And that's why a solution just for insulin is not enough, because we have the same problem in cancer drugs. We have the same problem in any novel treatments that we bring about, that if we don't negotiate and there is a monopoly, then prices will be very, very high. And they are always higher in the U.S. than in other countries.
Talking to Dr. Vincent Rajkumar, professor at the Mayo Clinic, looking at the price of insulin, a bill in the House aiming to cap the cost to consumers for their monthly insulin supply. But as Dr. Rajkumar says, that means that the cost will go somewhere else. He's looking for more fundamental solutions. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What would you want to see happen to bring down the cost of insulin or other expensive prescription medications? Do you rely on insulin or one of those other very expensive medications? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Rajkumar, I referenced earlier, a lot of people rely on insulin literally to live. Can you talk about what insulin means for people with type 1 diabetes and then type 2 diabetes?
Sure. Insulin is critical for our survival. Type 1 diabetics, and I think there's more than a million type 1 diabetics, 1 to 2 million type 1 diabetics in the U.S., they did nothing wrong. They just developed this autoimmune type disorder, and the cells that make insulin in the pancreas don't exist. So they need insulin for survival, and without insulin, they will die. And so it's for nothing that they did wrong. Now for their whole lives, they have to rely on insulin. And it's really important that we don't penalize them for a disease that they didn't have any control over. So for them, it's life or death. And so they will buy it no matter how expensive it is. And that's something that we have to keep in mind, that there is a product which is so important for survival that if you have a monopoly over that, then it does cause a problem. For millions of other Americans who have type 2 diabetes, insulin is still very important. And some people point out, oh, there's obesity or there's other things that you can control. Yes, but there are many, many people who need insulin to live a long life. If you don't treat the diabetes now, then we will pay extra to take care of the heart disease or any other problems that follow downstream. So insulin means a lot. It's a hormone we all need for survival. And we should try to make it affordable, just like it is in all other developed countries.
Now, given that this is a market, Dr. Rajkumar, I would imagine if it's a case where only a few companies are selling insulin at a high cost, another company, if I were another pharmaceutical company, I'd want to get in on it, undercut them a little bit, take some of this high demand market from them. Why doesn't it play out that way?
So some factors. One is that companies which own these analog insulins, like Sanofi, Eli Lilly, Novo Nordisk, they keep filing newer and newer patents on the same insulin, which trying to prolong the patent life and preventing competition from entering. Secondly, insulin is a hormone, so you cannot just make a generic. The analog insulin companies would have who want to enter the market would have to convince the FDA that they have a biosimilar that is exactly similar in bio, you know, in how it works to the parent compound. And that is a more difficult process than getting a generic drug approved, which is just a chemical and you can show that it's the identical chemical. So it's a harder process. So biosimilars have been late to come in. And naturally, because it's a biosimilar, only big pharma is making it. So some of the biosimilars we have on the market are also made by big pharma, and they also want to make money.
You've used the phrase analog insulin. What, and I've heard that elsewhere. What does that mean?
So the normal human insulin that we make in the pancreas is extremely good. But one of the best things that happened in the late 90s, 2000s was the analog insulin, which actually worked even better than human insulin, which when given externally to diabetics. Analog insulins have a more predictable time of action, a more predictable duration of action. And so most of the modern insulins that people use now are analog insulins. They're not exactly identical to the human insulin that we make in the pancreas.
How long have we had insulin as a medication?
Insulin's been around since 1921, but we have always made modifications to insulin. So it was the first, the beef insulin, then the porcine insulin, then the human insulin, and then the analog insulin. So every few decades, there's been a modification, and every modification meant new patents, and slowly that translated into higher cost.
Could somebody patent, I don't know, like, or produce an old school insulin, the stuff we were using 20, 30 years ago, and maybe it's not quite as good as this analog insulin, but it's still maybe life-saving?
It's still available. You know, the so-called Walmart insulin is Humulin. It's the human insulin. It's not analog insulin. It has some disadvantages. So for an insulin-dependent diabetic, it would change their lifestyle. You know, they would have to be monitored multiple times a day. Mm. They could get high and low blood sugars much more frequently. And so it's not fair to patients when we have products on the market for 22 years and 25 years that we tell them use the products that were around 40 years ago.
Do you have hopes that companies are going to get some of these different analog insulins on the market anytime soon that will help bring the price down?
Yeah, there are a couple of biosimilars already on the market. Now, the madness is there is that, you know, even say Eli Lilly is making what is called an authorized generic, which is taking their same insulin, putting a different label on it and selling it at a half price. You may ask, then why would somebody buy the full price version? People do buy it because, like I said, there's a lot of people who profit in the middle from a higher cost product. So, but that the existence of an authorized generic made by the same company that's making the parent compound and selling that at half price tells you what's wrong with our system.
Briefly, Dr. Rajkumar, what is your best hope for something that's going to happen in the next maybe few years to bring down the price of insulin for those who depend on it, just in our last minute or so?
I think insulin is the Achilles heel of the pharmaceutical industry because it's been around for 20 years and there's no, you know, it's a novel drug, therefore it's expensive argument. If we can solve, but we should use insulin as the face of the problem and then enact a change in that would affect all prescription drugs. Not to take away profits from any company, not to take away innovation. I work with pharmaceutical companies closely. I work on new drugs. I understand their importance, but it has to be fair. Medicare should be able to negotiate for the price of the drug based on the value it provides, just like other countries do.
Dr. Rajkumar, thanks again for joining us today. Dr. Vincent Rajkumar is a professor at the Mayo Clinic, editor of Nature's Blood Cancer Journal. He talked to us about the cost of insulin in the United States as Congress works on a bill to at least lower what insured consumers pay. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday. We're talking about all things noodle with the authors of the new cookbook, That Noodle Life. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.